Good Wednesday afternoon and welcome into Grant and Danny. At last, the boys are on the air for what should be a fun little hour of radio. We'll be with you until about 6:30. The Nats didn't play particularly well in a lengthy battle in Houston today. They lose a series against the Astros. Danny is in his home office, we'll call it. Looks like a couch in the basement.
Indeed, sir.
I'm in our Navy Yard Half Street studios. What's up, man?
Hey, dude. Truncated but not limited. We will pack 4.5 hours, the longest radio program in the history of mankind, as far as I know, into an hour plus of power. You and me were going to do it like sardines right in there.
ESPN's Aaron Schatz on the show at 6, covers the NFL. He's had a couple of Commanders-related pieces that caught my eye recently, including ranking them very high on his list of the teams most likely to win the Super Bowl. He does everything with an analytical bent. He comes from having created DVOA and kind of a numbers nerd from Football Outsiders. So I want to talk to him in 40 minutes today at 6. We should actually start with the Nats before we move on, oddly, because there's some significant news out of the Nats clubhouse today. They made their second pre-trade deadline deal, and there is continuing to be smoke on whether or not they're going to deal Mackenzie Gore, one of their two all-stars, the ace of their pitching staff. You know, I'm on board with trading him.
Same here.
I think it's going to be really difficult for the fan base if they do. Gore, after one of his worst starts of the season, who's been struggling lately, admitted after the game that, yeah, he is seeing a lot of the rumors and doesn't want to say that it's affecting him. He said, but I'd be lying if I told you it's not something I've been thinking about. So maybe his final start as a National, maybe the final pitch he ever threw was a two-run home run that cost him his ball game today, and he got removed right away.
Yeah, so you thought about that yesterday. Well, Mike, the Nats have played twice since you and I last spoke to the folks, since last evening, two games. Michael Soroka really struggled, not a great final audition, if there is such a thing, heading into the trade deadline. There's been some speculation around him, probably not as a starter for a first division club, but a useful arm. Velocity down, curveball was as bad as it's been in months, so that wasn't particularly great for his stock and value. And Mackenzie Gore, a name that obviously is bigger, it supersedes one start today, or a couple of hiccup starts in a row, quite frankly. This is a top of the rotation, maybe not a true one, maybe a two. Who cares? You still have to pitch big games, and you would if you went and acquired Mackenzie Gore. But, yeah, it's certainly not his best stuff. And, you know, this was one of those things that I don't want to say we thought we outgrew, GP, but got squeezed, I thought, on what could have been a strike three call. You're not the first pitcher to ever have that happen to you. The next pitch is the most important pitch. Next thing you know, home run, as you said, day unravels, and kind of off we go there. But, yeah, he's a human being. I mean, you can't help but see those things. These guys aren't dumb, right? You get to the major leagues, you kick around a little bit, you sort of see the score, and a team that's 20 games under 500 after the loss today, that's kind of spinning their wheels. Other guys have already been traded, I think three so far on this road trip since they left D.C. Yeah, you could certainly do the math, and that speculation has to enter your mind. It has to enter those kind of private conversations or text threads and things. It's human nature, and it's normal.
Yeah, he is struggling with his command, is what I see. I mean, he's lost his breaking ball that was so dominant at one point. This is probably a command and control issue right now. He just hasn't been as sharp post-All-Star break. And I think it has a lot more to do with that than the fact that he sees some tweets that say he might get traded before his starts. But the fact is that right before the break here, he's had a few of, you know, his worst outings of the season. I should say the deadline, less the break. But I think he's going to be fine. He's either going to be in Washington and he's going to get his act back together. He'll be traded to a contender. And we'll know as of tomorrow because the deadline is set for 6 p.m. tomorrow for Mackenzie Gore. In the case of both him and Soroka, who you mentioned, a start, two starts, three starts, none of that's really going to be a factor. If a team is interested in those players, it's because of the stuff that they have, the ability that they would have if you added them to your rotation or your bullpen. Results, certainly in a small sample especially, just don't matter that much. But I do think the velocity for a guy like Soroka could be a hindrance.
I think it has to be, right?
Yeah, just because you wonder, is the arm okay? The Nats are saying it is, but when you're down 2-3 miles an hour over a couple of starts, generally that's, you know, precursor of some issues. So I'll be curious to see if they can get something done with him. I do think they'll trade Josh Bell. Fascinated to see if they move Nathaniel Lowe, who's under contract through the end of next season as well. But the trade they made today, Danny, was a really good one because you dealt two guys that aren't going to be here next year who both were here for a cup of coffee as passerbys, basically. And you got two minor league players that are controllable for a combined dozen seasons. I mean, this is exactly what Mike DiBartolo
100%.
Should be doing. For those of you that didn't hear about the trade, the Nationals shipped relief pitchers, Andrew Chafin and Luis Garcia, to the Angels. Now, again, that's pitcher Garcia, not infielder Luis Garcia. Chafin's a lefty. Garcia's a righty. Chafin was signed in season as a 36-year-old to help just batten down the hatches and
just steady the ship a bit. Yeah.
Glue things down as the bullpen was falling apart. Luis Garcia, the reliever, actually recently touched 100, has been throwing 99. He's pitched 10 times for the Nationals, 38 times this season. I mean, he was literally here for hours. I mean, he has barely been on this team. So to put Chafin and Garcia together for the Angels package to go get Jake Eater, who's a 26-year-old lefty who was at one point in time a decent prospect in that system, and Sam Brown, who's a first baseman in AA, I think is brilliant. Neither of those guys is probably going to amount to much. There's a good chance Brown is never a regular starter at the major league level. Eater has pitched both in the bullpen, major league level, and as a starter in the minor leagues. 10.3 strikeouts per nine, by the way, as a starting pitcher in the minors, indicative of some decent stuff. Went to Vanderbilt, was a highly recruited player, fourth-round pick in 2020. So it's the kind of guy with some upside that you want to grab, frankly. You throw Brown into the deal, who's 23 and a AA. You get anything for the Chafin Garcia return. I'm going to be excited. And to get a guy who could be in the major league soon in Jake Eater and someone who just you add to the system to create more talent with Brown, what a win for DiBartolo.
100%. So if you've ever played fantasy sports, you know what one of these looks like, right? Regardless of your fantasy sport. You pick a guy up off the waivers who's, you know, just out there for anyone to pick up at any point in time, and he plays well for you, and you include him in a trade to somebody else and get something that helps your team, whether it's this year or in a keeper league for the future. That's literally what happened. These are scrap heap guys, with all due respect. They're big leaguers. But Andrew, anytime anyone wanted to sign Andrew Chafin, they could have. Same with Luis Garcia, readily and easily available. Incredibly low cost. Anything that you get back for someone that might be here in the future, part of the system, as you said, even if it doesn't, you know, put a hot air balloon to raise the tide of the system, this is the right thing to do. They should be doing this throughout, and it's kind of been a staple, frankly, of even with Rizzo here over the last couple of years. You sign guys to these bargain basement deals, hope they do okay for you, and you know, you send them on their way after they give you 100 games of hopefully decent baseball, getting a chance to play or pitch every day, you know. And this is the strategy, and this is very, very smart. No championships are won today, no banners, no one's throwing a parade for this kind of a trade, but it's just good, smart baseball decision-making where you probably got a little bit worse today for a team that's already plenty worse. So, yeah, you're already about to drop a whole mess of games. That's already done before this trade, same with after the trade, but it is smart.
It's two times now that they've done this because of the Rosario deal earlier this week. So three players traded that were not bolted down, that were pending free agents, that are what I would consider to be seat warmers, seat fillers. Rosario, Chafin, and Luis Garcia, the pitcher. And they have gotten back four minor league players.
Mm-hmm.
I'm stopping short of saying prospects. I think Eater's the only guy who's really legitimately ranked any kind of a prospect in baseball. And he's at 26 now, having pitched for a couple of years in the majors, even on the fringe of that. But you do add minor league players to your system to create competition, to just stockpile as much talent as possible. And that's a strategy. That can be beneficial. Sometimes you get a guy back, you have no idea what you're getting. Maybe Eater turns into a helpful lefty reliever. But they have four players that have come back, mostly between AA and AAA, three of them. One of them's a teenager who's been shut down with an injury for the rest of the season, who's in the Dominican Summer League and is a long ways away. But maybe a couple major league relievers for next season out of that deal. So anything that they can do to trade the veterans from this bad team, to your point, in a lost season where wins and losses right now just have not ever really been this insignificant. Because it's not even like if they lose, it's better. They are already a bottom five team in the sport at this moment, and they can't pick inside of the top nine. Remember the every other year philosophy now of the Major League Baseball draft. They had the second pick, got Dylan Cruz. Then they weren't allowed to pick in the top nine and got the 10th pick and took Seaver King. Then they won the lottery this year, picked first. Well, now, because of the CBA and the lottery, which I hate in Major League Baseball with all the quirky rules, they again will have to sit out the top nine because of the market they're in and the payroll and some of these other things. And so the best they can pick, they'll probably be on the clock at number 10 again. So even like people that are going with the Wizards tank, get the number one pick, the Nats can't even really control that part of it. So the wins and losses are borderline irrelevant. I care about things like James Wood getting out of his rut, C.J. Abrams finishing strong, if Mackenzie Gore is here, him not going into a second-half tailspin like he did last year, Jake Irvin not falling apart in the final month like he did. You know, these types of storylines as you project forward. But trade Rosario, check. Trade Chafin and Garcia, well done. Next up should be Kyle Finnegan. Josh Bell, absolutely, move him. Soroka, going to be a free agent at the end of the year. What can you get back? Add as much minor league talent as possible, because the cupboard, while not completely barren, is just not looking like what you want it to. They are a below-average minor league system with a big league team right now that is near the bottom of the standings.
GB, this is something that I'm going to care about that I bet you will not. I rubber stamp everything that you just said. I agree with you 100%. The wins and losses aren't relevant per se when it comes to draft position. It's not like the other sports. The baseball's rules are terrible in this regard. I hope they get changed ASAP. I understand the sentiment of not wanting teams just to be perpetual bottom feeders, and you have to incentivize something, but the way they do it is ludicrous. Make it so you can't pick first 2 years in a row. Let's compromise. Let's say the Nats finish with the second worst record. The best they can do this year would be fifth. Something like that. This nowhere in the top nine or whatever is ludicrous and it's insane. Here's the other part I care about, though. I don't like the ability, or I'm rooting against the ability, for someone internally to be able to go, you see, the problem was Rizzo and Davey. I don't want that to just be the scapegoat or the excuse when something is systemically broken here. So to me, the losses matter in the sense that I want no one to be able to hide at any point in time. I want no one in the ownership suite to be able to go, you know, we actually did a really good job this year. If it weren't for those two dinosaurs holding us back, we'd have been a lot better. Look at how good we were in the month of September or something like that. That's the only thing that I'm the slightest bit concerned about, is it's very easy to blame the deposed kings and rulers of your program, right? So that's the only other thing I say when it comes to wins and losses don't matter. They do a little bit in that regard to me as kind of a cynical, irritated, ticked-off fan of the club. But analytically, everything you just said is correct, and I would rubber stamp it.
Yeah, so they'd won three in a row after their opening game win over the Astros in this series. And at that time, they'd won 5 of 7, including two straight series. And they had a chance today, had they have won this rubber match with Gore on the hill, which going in on paper against a guy with a high ERA.
You feel pretty decent.
It felt like you had a chance to win a third straight series. Now, it didn't work out that way. They get clobbered. And by the way, if your ERA is over 5 and you pitch against the Nationals, congratulations on your quality start.
Have a day.
Your 6 or 7 really good innings where you don't give up any runs, enjoy those. Your career performance, I mean, it is such a lock.
Yep.
Next time you see a guy with a ERA close to a touchdown pitching against the Nats, jump on FanDuel and make yourself a couple of bucks if you
seriously
can.
The Dylan G All-Star team grows every day. It looks like a guy throwing cracked wiffle balls out there.
They're bad in general, but there are two scenarios where they are at their worst. One, is it a day game?
Yes.
They will lose, and they will likely embarrass you in the process. They are, I believe, 13-33 in day games right now this season. It is unbelievable. Getaway day, they can't wait to get on the plane. I mean, they're fining people for contact, it feels like. But the second thing that I would say about this Nationals team where they are at their worst is, are they facing a pitcher who is overmatched and doesn't belong in the big leagues? Because if they are, oh, he's about to carve them up like a pumpkin on October 28th. I mean, it is unbelievable how bad they are. When they face good pitchers,
yep,
they hit them and they score. Joe Ryan this week, who's an all-star, who's got one of the best ERAs in the league, they knocked him around like a boxer who, you know, went out partying the night before. They just left him bloody in the middle of the ring. But my God, when they face a dud of a pitcher like today, does it get ugly for this offense. But anyways, you would reference that you kind of don't want to see them string a bunch of wins together because then you start scapegoating and they don't make the changes they need to. I just don't think it's going to work that way. You know my opinion. I don't think they're going and really making wholesale changes as it is. There is a very likely work stoppage looming in Major League Baseball. We know this.
Mm-hmm.
Next year is the final year of the collectively bargained agreement. Going into the 27 season, there will need to be a new CBA. There is major acrimony between the players and the agents, the PA, and the sport. You all saw the story of Bryce Harper, Mr. Tough Guy, getting in the face of the commissioner in the clubhouse nose-to-nose and telling them to get the bleep out of their dressing room, right? That is just a small microcosm, a small look into Not Bryce Harper being a punk, which I guess you could say that was the case in that moment too. But the fact that players right now cannot stand the league and the way they're trying to operate with the implementation of, say, a salary cap and some of these things. So I bring this up to say, Danny, if we're really going toward a work stoppage like everybody assumes, I don't think the Learners are going to go out and hire some hotshot executive for $5, $6, $7 million a year to then pay that person not to work. I think that they would continue with what is going on now, which is, especially if DeBartolo, who's made two pretty good trades so far, can get a good return from Mackenzie Gore, or if he flips Bell and he flips Lowe and they have a successful next couple of days, they will have seemingly crushed it in the draft. We'll see if the players are any good or not, but the philosophy was brilliant. They got all their guys signed with the savings of taking their favorite player at number one. Then they will have had a quality deadline. I thought when they went to DeBartolo, he had a really, really good chance of keeping the GM job. Now I'm convinced of it, just based on the fact that I've got to convince myself otherwise that the Learners are going to pay an executive not to work for several months, who's a hot shot, who's one of the top execs in the sport that they brought in. You think they're doing that? I don't.
No, I don't either. I think status quo is the name of the game. And I guess what I should be more clear with what I'm trying to say. It's not just the GM position. It's the everybody gets to say in the organization, from the marketing intern to baseball ops to the ownership C-suite to who runs the team store, who the person in charge of concessions. Everybody's going to get to say, see the problem. It was Mike Rizzo and Davey Martinez. We fixed it, though. Now we're good to go. And everybody gets to kind of keep going back to the status quo. That's what I'm more referring to, right? It's a bit hyperbolic, but it was always the then Redskins sort of mantra and way of doing things. Dan would trot out the new savior, whoever that was, right? And then things would go badly, and then that person would get scapegoated, and we'd find the new villain, or we'd find the new hero with the new white knight that would come in, etc. And that's what I'm basically saying. Everybody over there needs to be looking in the mirror at all times, as if to say, what I was doing wasn't good enough. What we're doing isn't good enough. What can be better? And not just be able to hide behind, well, our record was better once we fired Rizzo and Davey Martinez. That's all I was referring to. But you're 100% right. The substantive change that is required from the billionaire family to make those kinds of introspective looks into things and to be able to say, hey, I need to do something different. Good luck waiting on that. Let me know how quickly that happens.
I'll be curious to see if some Nats fans who were listening to the game want to hop in on this. As I told you, we do have Aaron Schatz coming up at 6 o'clock to talk about the Commanders. He had a piece where he's got them as one of the most likely teams to get to the Super Bowl this year. We'll ask the ESPN number cruncher about that in about 20 minutes. But I want to know from Nats fans who have seen Juan Soto traded and were here for the dismissals, the exits of Trey Turner via trade, Bryce Harper in free agency, Anthony Rendon in free agency, and so many others, who watch games night in and night out with Schwarber and some of your favorite players on other teams now. If they traded Mackenzie Gore, would you understand it and get it? Or would that be damaging to your fandom in a way that could be irreparable to the fan base? 800-636-1067, if you want to hop in. We're one day ahead of the Major League Baseball trade deadline. Reports today that the Cubs, even the Yankees, are calling the Nationals about Mackenzie Gore. If they traded him, what would your reaction be as a Nats fan? That is the question on Grant and Danny.
Gore deals. Swing a high drive left field. Wood going back to the warning track. He'll watch it go. That is long gone to the Crawford boxes. Altuve's three-run homer makes it 4-1 Houston.
As heard earlier today on 106.7 The Fan, welcome back Grant and Danny. Aaron Schatz of ESPN on the Commanders' chances to make the Super Bowl. He crunched all the numbers. He joins us in 15 minutes. But Mackenzie Gore, for the second time in three starts post-All-Star break, scuffled today. Could be his final outing with the Nats. The trade deadline is 24 hours and 15 minutes from right now at 6 p.m. tomorrow. How would you react to a Gore deal? An all-star coming into his own as a front-of-the-rotation starter. Kind of a funny thing to talk about right now. There's some recency effect here where he's got an ERA over 10 in his last three outings. But a mid-threes earned run average, was one of the leaders in baseball in strikeouts all season long, only 26 years old. But he's only got 2 years of term left after this. He is Boris advised, and that means he's going to the market very likely. And it's long been said, even non-Boris, that he's the kind of guy that maybe isn't going to end up in D.C. Like, this is not a place he necessarily wants to be for the rest of his career. So if he's likely to leave in a couple of years, should they just flip him now for a nice return, being as far away as they are? That's the question for you on Grant and Danny. 800-636-1067. Danny is at home. I'm in our D.C. studios. Let's get to the phones. Edwin is in Silver Spring. What's up, Edwin?
Hey, how are you doing, Grant?
Good, thanks, man.
What's up, buddy?
Hey, how you doing, Danny?
Good
to hear from you guys.
Yeah, go ahead, man. Let's go.
All right. It wouldn't bother me at all. I don't think it would bother the fan base at all. I think he's much less a player in actual performance or just like his status or whatever compared to the guys that we traded and were upset over, like Rendon, Harper, or whoever else. I think, and then about him individually, I feel like his numbers make him look better than he is. I just don't feel like he's the number one in the rotation, yes, but I don't feel like he's an ace in the sense that out of five starts, I don't believe that you'd expect him to complete seven innings out of three out of five, or even reach the seventh inning. You know, he's not the type of guy who, if we're in a seven-game series, he's going to start twice, and we're actually going to depend on him to do stuff. You know, I just don't really believe in him. Or his talent, that, you know, that he's that type of guy. So I feel that if we traded him now, that would be the best bet because we're trading him as good as he's ever going to look. Or right now, there's as much belief in his potential, I feel like, that there would ever be. I think the longer he plays, the more he's going to get disrobed, more or less, you know.
Appreciate you, buddy. Thank you. So a couple of things. I think your issue in terms of him not going seven innings is more with the era we're in than him. Like, nobody really does that.
It's power arm like that, too. You know, it's everything's in every pitch and a lot of grunting and huffing and striking guys out. You could sort of see that star burning bright and not lasting as long.
I do think his point is correct, though, that he's the ace of the national staff. He's not a true ace starter right now. There's not 30 of those guys. Every team doesn't have one. There's probably 12 to 15 of them. On a World Series caliber team, I think ideally he's a number two starting pitcher. Like, you could win a division or make the playoffs with him as your number one. Because I'm of the belief still that he's getting better, too. He's only 26. Every year in the league, including this year, he's improved. 4.5 ERA to 4.4 to 3.9 to now 3.8, and that's after a bad stretch here. It's probably going to end up being in 3.4, 3.3, 3.5 range at the end of the year. And I still think there's a little more ceiling there. I've long been high on him. I love this stuff. 150 strikeouts, 120 innings. Like, this is an elite repertoire guy who throws 97 from the left side. So I like him a little bit more than the caller does in that regard. But his point is true that he's a number two type starter. He's also, and I would have asked him this if we could keep him longer, but we're keeping it moving here, Danny. He's clearly the best starting pitcher they've had since Scherzer, Strasburg.
Like, that without question, yeah.
Irrefutable. And for the next 2 years, building around him in the rotation, you could be a competitive team. Let's go to Campbell in D.C. What's up, Campbell?
Good afternoon, boys. The last caller said most of it. I think you guys agree. He's a number two anywhere else. Now, he might be a number three, but the issue I have is last season and this season, post-All-Star, he starts to wear down because, like you said, he's a max energy guy. And you're sitting there thinking, we're not going to be contending in 3 years. You might as well get as much as you can get for him right now. If you can't get a crochet deal done during trade deadline, wait till the winter meetings, like you guys said. But also, I don't trust the coaching staff to help him get better. His ceiling is real high, but Jim Hickey has not shown me in forever that he can develop a young guy. He's able to help good guys be good, but he has never helped a good guy become great. So, I don't want to see him go, but I know as a season plan holder, when I go to the ballpark, I know what to expect. And I was at that game where he got taxed in the first inning by Bogarts. He looked spent early, and today's game on the radio, he sounds spent. So
appreciate you, buddy.
Great call, buddy.
Yeah, that's the two starts he's referencing are these two since the break where he's given it up with the ERA over 10. I don't know that he's going to have as bad a second half, Danny, as he did last year. The sample's just too small with three starts. But last year, he had a bad second half, and he's off to a rough start. The only thing I'd push back on, because I think it was a really good call, he's not a number three. I'm just going to tell you that right now. Like, this is a lefty with an average fastball at 96-plus miles an hour and multiple off-speed pitches that get high swing and miss rate, who strikes out 11 batters per nine and was an all-star this year. Not Josiah Gray style, but an actual deserved legitimate all-star. So give me a break on number three. He is, for a really good team, if you have a true ace at number two, there's 20 teams in the league maybe, or 15 or so, where he would be the number one starter.
Yeah, he's really, really good. Going through a rough patch now, certainly. And that's every starting pitcher. You're going to find that. True Cy Young candidates, limit those. And, you know, you end up with the numbers that the sort of act accordingly there. But, yeah, he's really good. I mean, to me, the main part of this that you've seen, it's two angles. Angle one is the season ticket plan holder that's already spent the money. The Nationals aren't giving that back once they trade away Mackenzie Gore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, nobody's saying, okay, well, it's now 4A Freddie that's going to take his start, so we're going to knock $7 off of your 200-level seat. I get being frustrated by that. That's number one. But number two, from a baseball perspective, I'm pretty cutthroat as a general manager type person. I'm not one, but if I was, you guys wouldn't like me a whole lot. But in general, I would go, what is my window? When does that begin? If I was in a window that I wanted to be, which is right now, I would not be trading him. The same way I wasn't going to trade Anthony Rendon when we're winning 94 games. The same way I'm not trading Max Scherzer away when we're a World Series contender and on down the line. That's not the case. I'm looking at my timeline going, there's no spending in my near future. I'm not going to be a contender next year before this presumed work stoppage. My earliest window maybe is 2027. Beyond that, he's not going to be here. I know that. I've done the math. Therefore, right now, this is when your value is at its best. It's pretty simple. It's cut and dry to me.
Best case, you've got one season, meaning not this year, but the year after, where Mackenzie Gore is going to be a part of your rotation when you're competitive. And that's if you do things well the next couple off seasons. I just brought this up in another conversation, but it's probably a work stoppage at the beginning of that year. I don't even know how much baseball we're going to play. Hopefully, it's three quarters of a season or something like that. And maybe you can't operate as if we're definitely going to lose time, but I think that's the expectation around the sport. That should factor into this as well, by the way. Like, that's half of what you have left of Mackenzie Gore is that 27 season where there might be baseball games lost. Makes it even more, I think, reasonable to trade him. Let's go to Tyler, who's in Richmond. What's up, Tyler? How are you?
What's going on, guys? How you doing?
Hey, buddy.
I'm okay with trading him if they get back controllable major league ready talent. Also, I think the future of this team is going to come down to who are you going to get to manage this team and are you willing to spend money? Because any manager who comes in here may not want to be a part of a rebuild.
It's a great point. I mean, the manager question's huge. Again, are they going to spend big money or bring in a courted, beloved managerial candidate knowing that a work stoppage looms after next season? Paying that guy not to work, or even if there was no work stoppage, they've shown no inclination to do that in the past. You know, Davey was a first timer, was a kind of middle of the pack from what I was told in terms of salary, a little over $2 million after all the years he'd been here. I'll be very curious to see what that hiring looks like. But I do think in a Gore return, for the record, you would get high-end minor leaguers in level, like double-A, triple-A type guys that are closer. You'd have to get an arm back that can help you in the rotation sometime early to mid next season, I think. Now, you're talking about going and finding some of the top pitching prospects in the game for contenders that aren't ready right now to help them this postseason, maybe won't be ready until part of the way through next year. But I agree with that caller. I can't make the trade for four guys in single A that are lottery tickets that are really high ceiling. You need some pretty established talents that are closing in on the major leagues. Jim, Silver Spring, you get the last word. How do you think the fan base would deal with a Mackenzie Gore trade?
Grant, quickly, and I've called you many, many times, and I absolutely think the fan base, if they know anything about baseball, it's the time to move them is right now. You know, a lot of the veteran pitchers, starting pitchers that are available at this trade deadline are having really bad years. I mean, you may be able to get a pretty good haul for Gore just because the competition is so bad.
True. And how about Lugo? Seth Lugo just re-signed with the Royals, who would have been one of the top candidates to be traded. That made the Gore price go up again.
Yeah. I would also suggest, I agree with you, he's got number one stuff, but I think he's emotional, and I think he might be a little bit emotionally fragile. I mean, you know, he gets something goes sideways on him, and he tends to blow up and give up
home runs and that kind of stuff. That may be a function of maturity, but that's not a good sign. But they're not going to be good again. This rebuild is taking much, much longer. This is a bad baseball team. Rebuild's taking a lot longer than originally anticipated. They're not going to be good at least till 2028, even if they catch some breaks. So By the way, for years you would defend him on some levels, but I would say, in fairness to Rizzo, I had long been calling for his head. But there's also an element of, you know, the bad drafting really came home, you know, to roost in these recent years. But I got to say, they are absolutely snake bitten. When you and somebody like yourself who knows the system top to bottom, it's just not Travis Secor, Cade Cavalli. It's almost unimaginable. I mean, of course, it's happening to the Dodgers with veterans. It is almost unimaginable the injuries they've had among the young pitchers they've tried to develop.
That's crazy.
That might call into question whether they're doing something wrong with the way they develop them. But it's really hard to do a rebuild when you get these guys to the precipice and they fall apart physically.
It's a great call. A lot of good intel in there, Danny.
Appreciate you, bud.
They have dealt with a ton of injuries. Everybody does, but they certainly, in addition to just not having enough success in the parts they control, some of the things they don't control haven't gone their way either.
Yeah, well, you don't have an endless army of elite prospects, and the normal attrition and injury rate affects you. It looks worse. Like, Travis Secor was the bright shining light in the darkness, man, and they snuffed that light out for at least a season plus. You know, that ain't right. That ain't fair. That stinks. But if there were two other Secoras at different levels, one guy knocking on the door in AAA, another guy down at single A, you know, it wouldn't feel as devastating, because, again, that's normal. The pitching mechanic breaks down. That is a reasonable thing that happens when everybody's throwing 100 and you're probably not supposed to. But, man, oh, man, it just feels that much more like a kick in the giblets when you're going between starving wanderings in the desert for months and even years at a time.
MLB trade deadline about 24 hours from right now. Grant and Danny on the Fan. Aaron Schatz of ESPN says the Commanders have some of the best chances in the NFL to get to the Super Bowl. We'll ask him about that next. With Danny, I'm Grant. This is The Fan. The show's brought to you today and every day by the law firm Condori & Murad. Estate planning, elder law, real estate transactions, probate administration, they do it all. Check them out. They've got a Fairfax office. They're good dudes. They went to Lake Braddock High and George Mason University. Schedule a consultation with their team today. Mention us to get a discount. KMLawyers.com. That's KMLawyers.com. We've been talking Nats in the wake of their game today. They lose big in Houston to the Astros. They're coming home for a homestand now. But let's get to the Rude Guest Hotline and change things over to the football side of things. Rude, the most reliable heating and air conditioning products in the DMV. And that is where we find our buddy Aaron Schatz. You know him from his work over at Football Outsiders for years, creating DVOAs, now at ESPN. And he had two pieces that were Commanders-related that we wanted to ask him about over the last few days. Aaron, you're on in D.C. Thanks for the time. How are you?
Hey, I'm good, guys. How are you guys doing?
Doing well.
We're doing great. I want to start with what you put together for FTN, which was the highest chances to win the Super Bowl via your DVOA projection. So you're going to have to go into the specifics on how you kind of put this algorithm together. But I'll just tell people, you had the Ravens 1, which seems reasonable enough, 19% chance. You have the Bills at 14.7%. The Lions 3rd at 12.1%. And then number 4 in the NFL, better chance than the Chiefs, better chance than the Eagles. You have the Washington Commanders behind only Baltimore, Buffalo, and Detroit in terms of the highest chance to win the Super Bowl. So how did you come up with that?
Yeah, I mean, we put in, you know, ratings from the last 3 years. We look at personnel changes over the offseason. We look at, you know, things that tend to regress to the mean from year to year, and we put it all together. We do a book every year, the FTN Football Almanac. It's out right now. You can get it at ftnfantasy.com/almanac or search for it on Amazon. And, yeah, the big surprise projection is that we have Washington with a little bit better chances than the Philadelphia Eagles. There's a couple of things that go into that. One is that even though they're going to regress on fourth downs, there's no way Washington can be as good on fourth downs as they were last year. We do think that some of the personnel changes that they've made on offense help make up for that, you know, that decline, you know, adding Deebo Samuel, adding Laremy Tunsil. We think their defense can be a little bit better than it was last year, even though, you know, I know there's questions about things like pass rush. But also schedule is a big deal. Philadelphia has the second hardest schedule projected in the league. Washington's is only 12th. I'll give you a good example. Philadelphia has to play Buffalo while Washington plays Miami. There's a big difference between those two teams.
Who are the bigger difference makers? Jaden Daniels obviously is, you know, hopefully ascending year two, MVP candidate according to some. That's awesome. That's fantastic. Besides that, Aaron, where would this leap come from, or where would some of the other, you know, major difference makers here to jump them up in these kinds of rankings be? Where are they?
Well, I mean, it's not that much of a jump. They were a very good team last year. The jump came last year. Last year was when the jump was. You know, adding Tunsil is important because offensive line was an issue last year, and he's very good despite the fact that he does get a lot of penalties. Marshawn Lattimore was very good in the first half of last year. So if he's healthy, that's a big addition to the secondary. And if Amos can be good, that's another addition. Secondary has been a real weakness for them over the last couple of years, and they may have really improved it this year. So, I mean, I definitely, pass rush is a huge question. There's no, you know, that's no doubt about that. But those are big improvements. I think their defense can be average. Not good, but average. And if their offense can be what we think it can be, and they'll need McLaurin to sign, you know, not to hold out in order for that to be the case. But if their offense can be as good as we think it can be, an average defense is all they'll need to be a big contender.
Aaron Schatz, check him out, A-Shots NFL on social media. He created DVOA, ESPN NFL analyst. See him on FTN. So, all right, let's do this then, Aaron. How much different are things without McLaurin? You just referenced they need him to sign. Like, is there a way to even quantify that?
Yeah, I think McLaurin is a huge part of that offense. There's no doubt about it. We wouldn't project them over Philadelphia if McLaurin wasn't there. And they're depending on a couple of young guys like McCaffrey in depth if they have any injuries. So they cannot afford to lose McLaurin. He's hugely important.
In terms of who else might step up, I mean, Deebo Samuel obviously is new to the offense. You mentioned Laremy Tunsil before. We're hoping that the Luke McCaffreys of the world, we're hoping that fourth rounder Jalen Lane here in town is, you know, is something of a great find for them. A seventh round pick, Chakorry Crosky Merritt as a running back, we're hoping turns into something. But you see the main operative word there, Aaron, is hope for a lot of these guys. Who are some of the players that haven't really done it consistently yet at a high level that you guys have saying, hey, watch out for this. This might kind of account for this team being a legit contender?
It's less about certain players raising their game and more about just the team as a whole and how it's playing. Again, this team was like a seventh or eighth or something in DVOA last year. So all it's going to take is a little bit of improvement. If the defense, we had the defense 23rd last year, mm-hmm. right? To go from 23rd to what we're projecting, which is 17th, that's not a huge improvement. If you get a little bit more pass rush, plus you have Lattimore and Trey Amos coming in, then that's, you know, go up six places. That's fine. And then Daniels, look, here's the thing. When you play as well as Daniels did last year, you don't normally take a big year two step forward because you're already playing at such a high level. He just has to play at that level again. We're not expecting him to get better, but we're also not expecting him to get worse.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, Schatz has the Commanders with the fourth best chance to win the Super Bowl behind the Ravens, Bills, and Lions, joining us here on Grant and Danny. Along the lines of regression, where you're talking about you don't have Daniels getting worse, there were some things last year that feel unsustainable. Turnovers as a margin year to year don't always sustain. They were brilliant in that area, not turning the ball over. Another thing is fourth down percentage. And I know that the Ravens, as an example, Aaron, have benefited for years from the cheat code that is Lamar Jackson in fourth and short, and Washington should benefit from Daniels in the same way. So I don't expect them to be below average. But they were like 23 of 26 at the end of last season.
Good.
Like, that is just, there's no way that happens again. How do you bake that kind of thing into this, that it feels like there are some things where they were living a pretty charmed life last year? I saw on ESPN, I don't know who does this, but some guy came up with like a luck metric where they had the most dropped passes against them in the league. Like little things like that that might not show up.
No, it's true. That's all baked in. That's all baked in. But we just, the improvement of the talent, adding Tunsil, adding Samuel, they've made some good moves. There's a lot of positives here. And the other thing is, this is also about Philadelphia. Defense is harder to predict than offense. It is less consistent. People don't understand how much the Philadelphia team during the regular season was driven by defense. They were only 13th in DVOA in offense. They were number one in defense by a lot. And they've lost a lot of talent in the offseason. They are not going to be that good on defense again. And they have a harder schedule. So now you're talking about Philadelphia instead of being the best team in the NFC. You're talking about them being maybe the third or fourth best team in the NFC. And that boosts Washington a little bit because they have the easier schedule in the same division. That's why I see them as a more likely division champion, even though both teams are very good.
Aaron, where does Dallas fit in for you? Kind of, if it's possible to have a quiet offseason, they haven't. Certainly, Jerry Jones is loud and, you know, puts his foot in his mouth every other day. But in terms of improving the ball club, I think they're better right now than they were last year. How much of a threat are they in that division?
Well, just having Dak Prescott back healthy, it's hard to know what to expect from Prescott because it was not a very large sample last year before he got hurt. But he was nowhere near as good as he was the year before. And I'm not a big Brian Schottenheimer believer as far as Brian Schottenheimer as the head coach. Also, we just don't know what the health is of the secondary. Guys like Trevon Diggs and Deron Bland, you just don't know. I mean, obviously, Micah Parsons is like an awesome dude, but they're trying to get pass rush from other places. The secondary has injury question marks. I'm not big on Dallas this year. I think they're going to be more of an average team.
Aaron, I want to go back to the Commanders for a second and the other of the two pieces that you wrote where I thought it was very favorable to Washington and people should be very excited. You came out this week with your 32-team ranking for talent under the age of 25. Danny and I actually did quite a bit of time on the show about this yesterday. I was stunned that the Commanders were third, but I realized, okay, well, this has a lot to do with Jaden Daniels, who's going to age out next year. And my suggestion was when he ages out, they're probably like 30th or something like that. You know, because they really, I think you had Brandon Coleman as a blue chipper. You know, their best under 25 players, probably Mikey Sanders still, not named Jaden Daniels. Coleman, if he turns into a really good guard, I could have there. But otherwise, it's like this year's rookie class, hoping someone like Ben Senator, Luke McCaffrey breaks out. I mean, there's very little, and I blame the Rivera era for that. The Marty party and those guys that are gone, they just drafted terribly. First and second rounders not on the team. You had him third. What kind of reflection on Daniels is that? And if he wasn't there, what would that look like?
I mean, first of all, there are other guys. There's like Johnny Newton, right? And there's Sanat, who's a second-round pick, even though you haven't seen much from him. You just don't expect to see much from tight ends in their rookie year. So, you know, you got to expect Sanat's going to grow a lot. But it's mostly Daniels. I mean, they would be, I mean, probably average or below if it wasn't for Daniels. Yeah. So he ages out of this ranking next year. But what he is right now is the most valuable young asset in the NFL. Like, given how well he played last year, you would have to say that he's the most valuable asset under the age of 25 in the league. Probably C.J. Stroud is second.
What are we not appreciating enough about Jaden Daniels? just in terms of what you guys see, the data, et cetera, because that's a pretty profound statement. I think you're right, Aaron. The most valuable asset in the sport under 25, and which makes him one of the most valuable assets in the sport, kind of full stop there. What are we not maybe stopping and smell the roses on with him enough?
I don't know. Are Commanders fans not stopping and smelling the roses? Are you guys not as excited by this guy as everybody else? I mean, my colleague Nina Kimes did her quarterback draft episode of her podcast, and I believe they picked Daniels fifth, right? Like, we know who the top four quarterbacks are in the league. They're all in the AFC. Jackson, Mahomes, and Allen in some order. Burrow, fourth. Daniels might be fifth. Like, there's a number of guys who have a claim on fifth, but he's one of them. He's really good.
No doubt. I mean, he was an MVP candidate last year and could very well win the MVP award this year. I think for some of us, it's just like hard to fathom Washington being in the conversation or repeating last year, which felt like a magical carpet ride. But no, this piece that you put out that ranks them fourth best to do it, or you know, third best in the young talent, it certainly gives us some positivity, some optimism going into the season. I want to ask you about the top of that list where you have the Ravens, the Bills, and the Lions. I've been asking a lot of our national experts, who is the better chance to break through, Baltimore or Buffalo? Because I feel like Buffalo's schedule is a little bit easier. I don't know if that's true, but it seems like they've got a path maybe to finally be the one seed and host the Chiefs. Like, why do you personally agree? I know this is the DVOA metric. Do you personally agree that the Ravens have a better chance to knock the door down they've been kicking at than the Bills?
No, as much as our numbers have loved the Ravens the last 2 years to a ridiculous extent, one of the best regular season teams of all time. But I do think because of the schedule strength, Buffalo is more likely to have the higher seed. Buffalo is more likely to have the home field advantage throughout the AFC playoffs. And that means I do think Buffalo is probably more likely than Baltimore to break the string. But history is filled with teams that couldn't get it done in the playoffs until the year they finally did. A really good example, the LA Rams from 72 to 78 were like 66 and 19 or something. And in 79, they finally went to the Super Bowl. Like, it can happen. The problem is it can't happen for both of them. Only one of them can do it.
Aaron, super informative as always. Great collection of pieces. Giving us a lot of content here this week, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. FTNFantasy.com/almanac. Previews of all 32 teams, all of our projections. People should check it out.
Yeah, let me ask you real quick, if you don't mind, about that and just the work that goes into the almanac. I mean, you've got staff helping you out, I'm sure, but that's a nice asset that I've checked out. You've got done a really good job at the last couple of years. I mean, what is that undertaking like?
Yeah, it's pretty intense. We do it over about a 10-week period. We write the whole thing. I mean, I put all the numbers together before that, and then we write in about 10 weeks. I do have a staff of writers that write all the chapters. People know guys like Mike Tenier, Dan Pizzuto, Brian Knowles. They've been writing for me for years. There's a lot of film study that goes into this. There's a lot of humor that's in it. There's a lot of stats that's in it, and the most accurate team projections every year.
And where can people get it?
Either on Amazon, search for FTN Football Almanac 2025, or go to FTNFantasy.com/almanac.
And if you like data, analytics, numbers, smart insight, it's a really, really good resource. All right, Aaron, we appreciate you, buddy. Great having
you
back,
bud.
On as always.
All right, we'll talk to you sometime during the season.
Yes, sir. That's our guy, Aaron Schatz. He is, and it's not just him, Danny, but his metrics. I mean, these are numbers, so it's not like they're just fans of Jaden Daniels. It's an algorithm. They're very high on the Commanders.
So when we do this for, remember, the flip side, when we kept trying to tell people, we are not yelling at anybody, we're not ripping anybody, we're not saying anything other than, here's what the data says. Washington was very lucky last year, right? With the number of dropped interceptions, number of dropped passes by opponents, you know, these instances, these penalties, this turnover margin, etc. Washington was fortunate, right? These are just the numbers. And it was viewed as very negative and people can't handle the word luck. Well, here's the flip side of that. Here's the bullish, emotionless, you know, cold world of AI and data basically spitting out the simple fact that Washington is among the leading contenders to go win the damn Super Bowl. Like, that's not some guy going, let me tell you something about what Dan Quinn's building in terms of guts and family. That's not in DVOA.
There's no brotherhood metric.
Yeah, you know what I mean? There's none of that. They spit out the computer, gives you the best information possible. And again, it's not gospel, certainly, that teams outperform, underperform DVOA all the time or any other metric. All we're trying to do is quantify what it is that we're seeing in a sport that's hard to level and equalize. All that said is that's incredibly positive and bullish, and it's just as much you heard him about Washington being something that we're all hopeful they are, combined with the distinct possibility that it's really hard for Philadelphia or anybody else that's at the top to kind of keep sustaining that unbelievable level they've played at here over the last season plus.
Let's spin you around the NFL with some of the news of the day. The Commanders were off today. No training camp practice. They get back after it tomorrow. Dan Quinn will speak at 7:30, so you'll hear some of that press conference on the Junkies tomorrow. And then their practice is at 8 a.m. I'll be out there in the heat again, so we'll have interviews for you on tomorrow's show and a full practice report on Grant and Danny. But elsewhere, there was action in the NFL today on the practice field. Let's start with the Bengals. They have released running back Zach Moss. Moss is 27. He'll be 28 this football season. Last year, he started 6 games in Cincinnati. He only averaged 3.3 yards per carry. For his career, he's over 4 per pop. He at one point in time ran for over 5 yards a carry with Buffalo back in 2022. I'm a little surprised by this. He was not going to start for the Bengals, but it felt like he was a short yardage goal line thumper who could score some touchdowns, 16 of them in his career. He's played with the Bills, the Colts, and the Bengals, and now he's looking for work.
Yeah, he's, you know, to liken it to someone that you and I know very well, he's very Brian Robinson-y, right, in terms of his style of play. There's nothing flashy, nothing dynamic, but is always on rosters, is always kind of around, has played in a few different stops, to your point, and coaches are enamored with this style, with, as you said, that thumper, that between the tackles, downhill, punishing runner. He played a lot against Washington, if you remember, there in week number 3 when they played at Cincinnati in that thrilling game. And I'm going, thank goodness they give it to that guy instead of somebody else, right? I mean, that is a favor for the opponent. I understand he's still going to tackle him. He's still going to make plays, and that can soften up defenses. But he'd have a role for me, but it wouldn't be anywhere near as big as it's been over the course of his career.
Well, this is just one of those signs, too, of things coming at you quickly or how unforgiving the league is. I mean, remember, 60-year player, he broke his neck in 3 places last season. He was back and trying to make the team, began camp on the NFI list. And so I don't know if it's a situation where maybe he retires or they just don't think he's going to be ready. They went and got Samaje Perine, Taj Brooks. But I mean, the severity of the neck injury, we didn't really have the details until days before they moved on without him. And we, you know, weeks later, it was like, this guy's got neck problems, problems. And so finished on IR, and now you got to wonder what is next for him in his career. Speaking of the Bengals, maybe the bigger national story is Trey Hendrickson. His holdout is over. He is taking a page out of the Terry McLaurin playbook. He reported for camp. He is not practicing. Now, this is interesting, though. At least from what I could find today, Trey Hendrickson did not do the my ankles hurt bit that Terry McLaurin is doing. He is not, that I've seen, going to be placed on physically unable to perform list, which seems like a better strategy because theoretically, McLaurin has the leverage to just, I don't want to say pretend to be hurt, but pretend to be hurt all season long, and then you just get transferred to injured reserve and you accrue the season because it's just like being on IR for tearing something, right? Like, you get to free agency that way. It sounds like Hendrickson just showed up and said, I'm not practicing because of my contract until I get a new contract. So not exactly the same as McLaurin, who is dealing with a foot and ankle problem.
Yeah, I hope it's okay,
he said in air quotes. But Hendrickson's hold-in begins today. So both of the guys that were holding out are now holding in.
Yeah, I wonder what the logistics are. And you know what I mean? I wonder, it seems like everybody now is talking about the focal point of getting the deal done. Hendrickson certainly is. And Joe Burrow now stumping for him the way he did for his 2 receivers.
Hadn't he been doing that for weeks, though?
Yeah, but now that it just feels renewed because he's there on campus. He's there, you know, around. It's not far away. It's, I want that guy paid, someone that's already present for. So who knows? Again, I don't know how it's going to work. I know Cincinnati finally came to terms with their first round pick. No, this is not 1995. This is 2025, where this is supposed to be commonplace and normal, but not the way Cincinnati does it. They do their own thing, and it finally just happened where Shamar Stewart came into camp this week. So I wonder how, you know, it's easy to compare these two situations in terms of Hendrickson and McLaurin. Hendrickson probably a little bit more productive at his position than McLaurin's been, but the discussions are very similar. Excellent player, been really good, done everything you've ever asked him to do. Now it's time to pay him, but it's not like he's 24. Therein lies the rub. And for Cincinnati, it's more complicated because they've already paid handsome prices for three other players, top of the market values for Chase and Higgins, and of course their star quarterback, Joe Burrow.
Yeah, Hendrickson has led the NFL in sacks over the last two seasons with 35. So, four-time Pro Bowler who's been an All-Pro. I'm going to say there's a sizable gap between him and Terry, but I certainly get your point. They're both vital to their organizations. Last one here as we go around the NFL on Grant and Danny. Bad news for the Ravens. I know this is a guy you were high on last year. I've really liked as well. Tight end Isaiah Likely, the 25-year-old, going into the final year of his rookie contract. Danny, he's scheduled to make about $3.5 million, trying to have a big year so that he can hit the market and get paid. Former fourth-round pick. I think he went to Coastal. Set career highs last season with 42 catches, almost 500 yards, six touchdowns. Had a really nice start to the year with Mark Andrews, kind of off to a slow start. Well, he's got a fracture in his foot. He's going to miss roughly 6 weeks. They're hoping it could be closer to four to six weeks, and he could come back for week one. They open against the Bills on September 7th. My guess is he will not be ready for that first game, though, with a 4 to 6 week timeline.
He is really dynamic. He's one of those guys that I think if he got that full-fledged, honest-to-goodness, tight end one type treatment, could put up some pretty special numbers. Again, I don't know
he's
how.
He's a matchup problem. Like with his speed and length and the leaping ability, he's listed 6'4", 250. He just plays huge. I feel like he's always going up and getting rebounds.
You know, I don't know how good he is as an inline blocker, which some places matters more than others. That's a matters place, talking about Baltimore. When you've got Derrick Henry back there and the best running quarterback probably in the history of the league, you know, with all due respect to Michael Vick and whoever else you want to throw in there, Lamar Jackson is a weapon. There's going to be plenty of running plays. There's going to be plenty of action where you'll have a choice, and you're going to have to be an effective blocker if you're going to play in that system and be that true number one. That's why I don't know if he's ever going to be that full-time dude there in Baltimore. He's a great supplemental piece. You know, if you go a two tight end look, think back to what the Patriots were doing years ago with Gronk and Aaron Hernandez. If you go regular base, one of those guys is running by you. If you go nickel, you'll get knocked into next week by the tight end. Now teams are countering out a little bit more with that bigger safety with, you know, kind of that hybrid linebackers thing. But I think Likely is a dude that could go somewhere else and really become a star.
That is your trip around the NFL. Again, the Junkies at 6 a.m. going to be on during the Dan Quinn presser at 7:30 tomorrow. So I'll be looking forward to hearing what he's got to say before a 8 a.m. practice that has been moved up an hour for the Heat. I'm sure that'll be comfortable out there for the fellas in Ashburn. Big thanks to Darius and Bennett and Ryan for their work on the production. Grant and Danny saying so long, an exhausting hour or so of radio today. After the Nats played a lengthy game and lost to the Astros. Linnell has overtime coming your way next.
Thank you for coming.